Kia ora and welcome to Worker's Voice. Spend the next hour with us as we discuss the tribulations and triumphs of building workers' rights and increasing fairness in the workplace. This show is produced by Unite Union.
Hello, hello. This is Hannah here from Unite Union, sitting around the table with some fantastic people. Shall we go around and say hello, everybody?
Hi, I'm Joe Carlin, and I'm senior organizer with Unite.
Kia ora,
Joe. I organize seniors.
Hi, John Crocker. I'm an industrial officer with Unite.
Hi, I'm Anu Kalotti from Migrant Workers Association.
And I am Unite's cinema organizer, Hannah. So we've got a couple of issues today. We're just going to get a bit of a debrief from Joe. He's been around the world a wee bit. Where have you been, Joe?
I was in London and Geneva and Dublin and Belfast.
Were you on holiday?
I would have liked to be. Yeah, towards the end of it, I got a couple of days with my family back in Ireland. That was good.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So what were you up to in the UK? I saw a lot of news media.
Yeah. Well, we had Britain's first mixed strike. Workers in New Zealand, in Britain, have been organising in McDonald's for about 2 years, and they've been building towards going industrial. So there were two stores that went out in strike, one in Crayford in Kent and one in Cambridge, which was kind of north of London. So I was on the ground helping the campaign in the weeks leading up to the strikes, with media strategy, with kind of getting the campaign sorted and kind of a united front. And then, on the day itself. Yeah.
Oh, cool. What kind of obstacles did the company put up?
It's interesting when you go to another country, because you can always see the pros and minuses of a different country. I mean, one of the big pros in Britain at the minute was that things have got so bad underneath their Tory government with austerity and even things like Grenfell, where all the people were burned in the high-rise building, that like anger amongst the working class is at a level where class consciousness is starting to kick in. People realise it's us against them. They're rich and they let us burn to death. Mm. And so there's a very high level of anger, which isn't just spilling out in terms of riots. Like people kind of expected. I was down in kind of Notting Hill, which is like the biggest music festival in Europe, and there was like 2 million people on the streets, huge sound systems, and like heaps and heaps of riot police, thousands of riot police in all the side streets, ready in case anything kicked off. But what's interesting is it isn't doing that. The anger is actually being channeled into things like the Labour Party and into things like unions, and there's been a youth quake. So about 3 million young people registered to vote and voted Labour because Labour was offering socialist policies. It was very clear what it was saying. It wanted to bring in a £10 an hour minimum wage, which would lift the income for a lot of young people. It wanted to bring in free public education, you know, not 1 year per term for the next 9 years, whatever New Zealand Labour was doing. This was like instant, and abolish student debt. And like a whole load of other things, like renationalising railways and taxing the rich, you know, being very clear how they're going to fund all this, you know, hitting back to 1%. So that was really good, like to see this country where there's all this kind of energy and like anger. And like some of it was very poignant, like going down to Grenfell and kind of meeting some of the residents there. I mean, it's not a superficial thing. It's not a shallow thing. I mean, this is a deeply held anger or passion that a lot of people have. They're sick of being treated like, you know, like that film I, Daniel Blake, you know, they're sick of the humiliation, they're sick of this stuff, they want change. And for the first time in decades, there's a political party and movement willing to voice that and come up with solutions like that and a plan for how we can make society better. So that was very, very good. And then, although we'd been invited over because the movement in New Zealand has had some tangible victories that the rest of the world wanted to hear about, and that was like including the International Union in Geneva that we talked to, for example, the defeat against Zero Hours, but also other stuff like we got rid of youth rates, we've unionized fast food, which is huge news to the rest of the world still. But you can see then that we're missing out on some things that they have in other countries. And one thing that they were able to do was they were able to strike in workplaces, not just for health and safety reasons like in New Zealand or for collective bargaining like in New Zealand, but you can strike in a workplace against bullying.
Oh, really?
And that gives me all sorts of ideas. And so these two places where they went on strike, they kind of got collective grievances about the managers who'd been bullying and harassing people for years. And they had their strikes, like, not just for the national demands for £10 an hour and the youth rates and the union, but also to roll the managers in these workplaces. And they did. So, and they were sacked like before the strikes began. So this was like already there was this discovery of their own power.
Yeah. So a pretty empowering time for those workers then, I bet.
Oh, it was brilliant.
Good fun.
Brilliant. And all these people that you meet, I think you meet them in every store in the world, you know, the same characters. I mean, Shane, the young woman who led a lot of it, God bless her. You know? I mean, that lovely mix that happens in London of different cultures. So, like, her family were Turkish. Her mother was Irish-English. She, like, a lot of Cockney mannerisms. Mm. All the kind of Cockneys have been moved out now to Kent and, you know, with all the kind of Dockland development taking over the original East End. It was just a great mix of all these different cultures and characters. When I went out to this place, I was a bit scared because the last time I'd been out near Welling in the East End was the big fights against the BNP. It was considered like a right-wing, kind of rights for whites kind of section. Mm. And yet some of the people who'd been on strike had been won over from like right-wing parties like UKIP the English Defence League and, you know, had now like swung to Labour and swung to the idea of unions and were on strike. For the migrant workers and the EU workers, who are now the new oppressed minority since Brexit, in the back, you know, so that these are apartheid where all the British workers were at the front and all the people working in the kitchens getting burned and stuff were the migrant workers. So it's not just a great strike that happened in like for you know all the reasons that we built the movement here, you know, against low pay and stuff. But it's also like you had this feeling that was like a little microcosm of how England is changing at the minute. Yeah.
So with that growing consciousness, how do you think the May government's feeling?
Well, I imagine they're feeling under siege. Yeah. I mean, they're just a rotten fruit that should be knocked off the tree. You know, everybody knows that they've no right to rule. That they're just being propped up by some rotten oranges, DUP. And you know that that Corbyn and McDonnell are kind of the government in waiting. That they're ready to move in, and they've got a plan. Whereas these guys don't. They just like you know move from disaster to disaster. They don't know what they're doing with Brexit. They don't know what they're doing with the economy. They don't know what they're doing with workers.
Right? It almost looks like they don't really want to be there anymore.
No, they do.
They do. You reckon?
Yeah, they're born to rule those people.
Yeah, speaking of rotten fruit, should we get into our election a bit closer to home? So we've been patiently waiting for, 3 weeks now? Is it 3 weeks?
About that.
Gosh, time flies.
Yeah, 20. Since the special vote was counted, what was it, 8th of October? Yeah.
Okay. So Winston's due to come up with something from a fishing trip that he's been on this weekend or something like that.
Interesting.
I hadn't heard of that. hope he caught something good. For the workers, maybe.
Well, you know, people have been talking about this election and kind of, you know, whoever you voted for, it doesn't really matter. Winston will get to decide what it is anyway. And I suppose that's kind of like a weakness of this kind of system, you know, that you can you think you're voting for a party because they're voting for policies, right? But then these policies get watered down or they get traded off against each other, you know, when they do coalitions, right? And then you don't get to vote for the party leader because that's selected by the party members, and then you don't get to vote for the people who are on the list, because that's decided by the party. So what do you vote for? Like, what are you voting for in a democracy?
In an ideal world, I'd be voting for workers' rights, ordinary people's lives being made better. But I guess this is the first time ever I've lived in a country where voting is so confusing. Just explain the whole MMP system and how it's just, I think it just sucks. To give you an example from my community, we've got Mr. Kamaljeet Bakshi, who's, I think, the longest-serving MP of Indian origin. Now, he's supposedly the most senior, the most experienced, and he got only about, I think, just under 4,000 votes, which kind of... there was another newcomer from Labour Party, and this is the first time she was in an election. She got nearly 7,000, and there was another young guy in Labour of an Indian origin. He got something similar. So it kind of... these people know that they will be picked from a list of an elite group. So the whole thing of casting your vote, that's just a joke. So that's what you see from that example. Somebody who's been in it for 9-10 years and he gets just under 4,000 votes, but he's still got a job, a very well-paid job. So from that perspective, I think it's about time New Zealand changed its electoral system to something that will actually where people can actually have a say in the whole thing. Now we see, despite people have cast their votes, there's only one person who now holds the power at the moment, Winston Peters. And, from his history, we know he can go either way. He's had coalition with National, he's had coalition with Labour. So no one knows which way he's going to go. We can talk about policy. We can carry on in the next segment, talk about the policies of each party and, who's going to go with whom.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And we'll take a break for a song now and we'll be back to it. Hi again. We're just discussing the New Zealand election, well, lamenting over it and basically the system that we have and how the choice basically comes down to Winston Peters to make for the whole country. So has anybody read New Zealand First policies in detail? What are we up against, guys?
Well, I was lucky enough just to come across a quite hilarious interview Winston Peters did. He was taken apart by a major journalist, part of a series. It seemed he hadn't read his policies. The journalist referred back to the website and what New Zealand First stated policy was, and Winston Peters wasn't even aware of it. So at that point, you've kind of got to wonder what it's worth. It's all good to talk about it, but you know, what does he really stand for?
Well, and, you know, people are saying Winston's the person who's going to decide, but I think the reason why we don't know who the government is when this has been recorded is we're waiting on a board, the board of directors of New Zealand First, who people don't even know who they are, like this anonymous group of 10 people, some of whom were at funerals or who couldn't get leave from work, you know what I mean, to make the decision that the country's waiting on. So, you know, that's another level of, you know. And I think it doesn't matter, really, because in the end, he's the person who makes the call. I mean, I can't really...
Can't imagine board going against him, can you? Yeah. I think it's a nod to some kind of democracy. So
yeah,
it's not,
and I
got
to say,
really,
if I wanted to delay making a decision, I too would consult with an air quotes board for as long as possible.
Yeah, so these could be possibly corporate CEOs who are going to pay into, who pay New Zealand First. I mean, I'm not making any accusations or anything, but a board, that's what I visualise when I think of a board.
I don't know. It's pretty anonymous, you know. I don't even know if there's anybody that caliber, you know.
Is it too late to try to get on the board? Maybe we could all do that after this. We could all try and pay our way on the board.
But, you know, he's going to make his decision anyway. I mean, look.
Well, still, if you wanted to stage a coup, now you know where the real power lies. You know? See yourself out 3 years in, you know. Take some positions on the board. Swing the vote.
What, you mean the radical left could hold
the radical down. Left could grab control of the New Zealand First board, like salt it, you know, go in. Just stay silent, agree with what he says for 3 years, and then, ha-ha!
Well, that'd be easier than building our own party, John, wouldn't it? Yeah. But, I mean, no matter what happens, I mean, I think there will be changes, right? So when we were negotiating with a very large company in the city centre recently, we were kind of relaxed there because one of the major policies that I do know about is that he wants to raise the minimum wage. To
is
the living
is that on
wage.
The website or out of his mouth?
No, it's on his website. I've read the policies in detail, and I think they possibly are one of the most detailed compared to all other political parties. But there's a lot of contradictions there as well. Like, for example, they want to increase the legal minimum wage to $20 per hour. And then you keep reading a bit further down that it comes to our health system. It just fully sounds like they want to privatize our health sector to the extent that they will give tax incentives, tax breaks to people who opt for a private medical health insurance. So, you know, what good is that $20 per hour going to be that you're going to be taking out of people's pockets in form of paying for health? And I mean, there's other stuff that sounds good on the surface, like he's against sort of like foreign interventions, like he's against the TPPA, but then there are a lot of contradictions there, so I'm not too
contradicting certain. Like the policies contradict each other, or do you just think it's not really consistent?
Both, because once you sort of start reading through, I just had Winston Peters making these speeches and lectures. That's how it all turned out in the end. So it is mostly about this just one person. I guess, we all know New Zealand First equals Winston Peters, so... Yeah, the policies, very much sound like...
And as you say, I mean, there's a bit of a mixed bag there. There's the good and the bad, right? You've got to sift through. I mean, because, I mean, this is possibly the end of neoliberalism, right? I mean, And the National Party was kind of running a Keynesian kind of borrow and spend thing anyway since the Christchurch earthquake, right? So we haven't had that ruthless, you know, austerity kind of stuff like people have had in Britain, right? They've been borrowing a lot of money to keep the country going, right? Yeah. But I kind of, Winston's return to old school kind of consensus conservatism, if you like, where, you know, between the end of World War II and the 70s, late 70s, when neoliberalism kicked in, there was a consensus amongst the bosses and the kind of bureaucrats that certain things in a society would be provided, you know. You know, after we mobilised our millions against fascism, you know, there was this kind of thing that workers need at least blah, 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 right? So they built state houses, they built kind of education and health systems. And I think, you know, there's been a part of kind of old kind of Muldoonism to Peters where he'll be looking for a legacy from this term to be remembered for doing something, right? So for all workers, I mean, getting from where we're at to $20 an hour, that'll be good for us, right? And so you take that energy and you kind of go to the bosses, things have changed now, you know what I mean? And I think, you know, we might be seeing $1.25 increases in the minimum wage, you know, but if we do our job as well, I mean, we need to keep the movement going in the workplaces and on the streets. The negative, though, is kind of a soft Trumpism that actually fits in well with Labour rather than National, actually. You know, Labour, and we should talk about this a wee bit, now we're here, I think ran a bad campaign. I mean, it got energy from Jacinda, the Jacinda effect, in the early weeks because it was a new, fresh, 37-year-old young woman leader, you know, who looked like she was going to do it.
Let's do this.
Whatever it is.
Yeah, whatever this is.
And then that kind of came off the wheels a little bit towards the end, particularly when it came to tax, you know? And I picked up on this with our workers in Sky City, right? Like, they were very clear about who they were going to tax when it came to the workers and poor, i.e., you know, a tax on Auckland drivers, you know, to build a railway that, you know, mostly wealthy people go to the airport to fly away. So it'll be the poor workers who will fund that, you know, monorail. Monorail to the airport. And that didn't go down well with workers, actually. You know, because then, when you talk about, you know, whereas you look at Corbyn and McDonald, they're going, hey, tax the rich.
Yep.
You know, get the boot off our class and tax them buggers, you know. And so, like, you know, those suggestions that we made, you know, tax the buggers. You see, if you don't tax them, then workers think, well, then you're going to tax us, right? And so that kind of hesitancy or whatever, or that fiscal responsibility within the rules, but I think people picked up that were there. And then also, I think if you, and maybe Anna, you've got more details of this, but if you look at areas with high immigrant populations, that there was a story to be told there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, within my community, especially like South Auckland, a lot of Indian people there. For the first time, I was quite shocked to see that working class people, they were supporting the likes of ACT Party. And I saw many fundraising dinners where they had David Seymour and he was being presented with like $30,000, $40,000. So that was a really strange phenomenon to witness, you know, what is going on.
Didn't do much good, though. No, it didn't.
Yeah, the candidate that they had from South Auckland only got 162 votes. And he's supposedly a very popular person within the community. And anyway, by the way, so yeah, didn't really see so much support for Labour. There was more ACT, even New Zealand First. They held one of their events in South Auckland at the Vodafone Event Centre, which, like, there's a lot of Indian people that I know went live on Facebook from that event, and they had all praises for New Zealand First. National, that they've got the core business community of migrants that I think traditionally supports National anyway, so that didn't change. So they had their vote. So, yeah, it's very, very odd. And I think some of the reasons behind this, Labour didn't really do themselves any favours by announcing that, you know, they would cut the number of migrants coming into the country in the future. They said they would have 20 to 30,000 coming in, whereas at the, I think the last year we had 70-something thousand come in. And before that, we had the whole the purchase of houses in Auckland in New Zealand, where Phil Twyford, who's the I think the housing spokesperson for Labour, he did some sort of survey, which we still don't know who did that survey, because they won't reveal that source. The outcome of that survey was like people with Chinese sounding names are investing in houses. We don't have any basis for that. So that, and then the cut in the immigration numbers, just Labour portrayed themselves as very anti-migrant. So that cost them a lot of the migrant votes, the way I see it. And then now if they do form a coalition with New Zealand First, like, you know, we discussed earlier, their policies are similar. Winston wants to cut it down to 10,000. So, you know, they'll be suited to each other if they're going to form a coalition there. And out of all this, you know, while I don't agree with cutting numbers like that, because our economy is heavily dependent on migrants, on immigrants, while I don't agree with that, but say, let's suppose they can do that going forward. What about tens of thousands of migrants on temporary visas who are already here? No political party has spoken about them. No one's offered any settlement policy for those migrants who are already here. A large number of those are actually international students who have been brought here with they've been sold a pipe dream, and, you know, they've been promised that their education, their world-class education, will be a pathway to residence. So who's going to look after those people? No single political party has offered anything. No one's proposed anything for those migrants. Instead, they're willing to just kick that lot of migrants out, replace them with another batch who will be equally, if not more, vulnerable. And then, you know, the cycle of exploitation just goes on and on and on. So.
Yeah, very sad. We'll take a short break and get back to discussing migrant workers in New Zealand.
Punishing pensioners and taking away school meals from our children.
Shut up!
Tax cuts for the Conservatives' big business friends.
Shut up!
More food banks, more homeless people.
Shut up!
There is a social crisis looming in Britain. This government's proposing to reduce it further and actually hand roughly £60 billion over to corporations and in tax relief at the top end. Instead of doing that, we should be asking the very, very wealthy to pay a bit more. The alternative is what? More food banks, more homeless people, more people on housing waiting lists, more queues in our hospitals, more than a million people already waiting for service.
Right, and we're back again, and we've just been talking about migrant workers in this country and just remarking on how none of the political parties actually committed to any policy on the temporary work visas that we have in the country right now.
It's very sad, and it lets down a huge workforce that's already here. Migrants for things like housing shortage in Auckland, for traffic in Auckland. I mean, those are the classic things that Labour's done. They should have been blaming the last government and possibly the previous Labour government as well, who haven't properly invested in the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're going to bring in large numbers of people into a country, you've got to make sure that you've got the infrastructure to support it. These people haven't just arrived illegally, or they haven't just dropped out of the sky. They are all here on legitimate visas issued by Immigration New Zealand. So the government knew what they were doing. They knew in advance how many people they were letting in. So it was easy, I think, for them to plan to look after these people. Going forward, I think the organisations like Migrant Workers Association, trade unions, any other social activists out there, I think we have been demanding that these people be looked after properly and they get their rights, especially like exploited migrant workers. And going forward, I think we need to carry on doing that, and we need to do that even more. As soon as we find out who the next government is, I think we need to have our strategy ready. We need to have our action plan and be in there straight away. That people who are here on temporary visas, you got to settle them. Mm. Don't just bring in more people. And all it does is when... especially governments blame migrants for their own shortcomings, all it does is it divides the working people, it divides the working class. People who are permanent here or residents here, they see temporary visa holders as their enemies.
Yes.
But in actual fact, what happens is it just drives wages down for everybody. It makes working conditions unfair and unjust for everybody, not just the migrant workers. Mm. So, you know, they're just using the migrants as an excuse to oppress the other workers as well.
It stops workers unifying. Like, just going back to what you said before, Jo, about how in London, how workers are previously would be divided along race lines, how that's not the case anymore. Like, I think that this country is tiptoeing around racism and not really sure where it's going to go, and it needs to realise that that's just a...
Yeah, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture of England either, because there's forces on the right who are growing as well. I think what we're seeing is the centre is collapsing, and you're seeing movements on the left rise and movements on the extreme right rise, just like in America too, right? I mean, when I was on the tube going to one of the strikes, I was wearing like a Unite t-shirt. And this guy came up to me and went, "You trade union guys all need a bullet in your head." Forget it, it's never going to happen. So there's like lots of radical right people in Britain with the Brexit and with racism and Football Lads Alliance and English Defence League, all this kind of stuff.
Did you say Football Lads Alliance?
Yeah, that's the latest. They've got to kind of come up with these new fronts because they keep exposing... you know, the Nazi core in these racist movements all the time, so they've got to kind of repackage themselves. So this is the latest thing, the Football Lad Alliance, yeah. Just before we go on, Anu, just for fun, I divided $30,000 to ACT with the amount of votes they got. It was 162. That's $185 a vote.
Oh, okay. All right.
Keep them going.
Yeah, I think it was 30. It might be slightly more or less, but yeah, okay. Right.
Well, it's good to see that party out of government. You know? Yeah. So it's gone out of government. Hmm. But to get back to this kind of, people playing around with the fire of race. And, you know, okay, New Zealand first, we expect it from Winston, right? That's kind of the demagoguery that he's been doing for years. And I'm not too sure how extreme he is when he's in power, because he was in power with Labour in the 2000s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there wasn't a huge dramatic slashing of figures then. So okay. I think it's something that he rolls with, but, you know, there'll be some tweaking going on, right? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, what's more disgusting... is that parties of the left started using this argument, right? Mm. Now, we had an argument with the Greens, the Migrant Workers Association, when they talked about sustainable migration, right? Yep. And we were kind of saying, what the hell does that mean, sustainable migration? You know, it's like, does that mean Shania Twain can come? You know, she's kind of cool and we like her and she can buy a ranch somewhere in the South Island, you know. But we don't want thousands and thousands of poor people coming from Indonesia. Mm. Well, who do you think the eco-refugees are going to be? They're going to be poor and they're going to be brown and they're going to be from the Pacific. So what's this sustainable migration stuff mean? Because that can only mean certain people and not certain other people. Yep. Well, who's going to be that then? It's going to be the rich and the wealthy white people, and it's not going to be the poor in their millions fleeing eco-disaster, right? But so I think that was interesting, and maybe you could talk about it later, how that kind of got dropped from the Green Party policy in the middle of their civil war, which happened in the election. But more worryingly is Labour pushing this, right? Because what's happened in Europe... is that the far right started blaming immigrants for jobs and houses, right? That's the old Nazi far right trick. And those crises are caused by government not building houses and not giving enough jobs and companies in the system. But then the Social Democrats, rather than take a strong stand against racism and go, absolutely not, bullshit, right, which people like Corbyn and McDonald are actually doing, they start... dumbing down the stuff to the lowest common denominator because they don't want to alienate so-called white working class voters, right? Mm. And they start like doing a softer version of the extreme right. I saw an interesting meme on Facebook, and it kind of, the logic of lesser evilism. Did anyone see that?
No.
When the left, you know, doesn't be the left and it goes to the center, and then it just politics just keeps moving to the right all the time, to the right, you know. So I think that's what's bad. And if there is a Labour New Zealand First government that's against, you know, or perceived to be against migrants, you know, the dynamic could be very different too.
Yeah. What another thing that it's done is because we do have migrants here who have been here 30, 40, 50 years, like more settled migrants. It's also caused quite a division between the more settled migrants and the newly arrived migrants. You know, they sort of don't see eye to eye, and I'm quite shocked when I see people within my community who've been here 20, 30 years, that they want the newer ones, especially the students, they just want them kicked out.
Oh.
It's like, you think, come on, people, hey, how can you forget? About 20, 30 years ago, you came to New Zealand and you were in exactly the same situation.
But is it because those people now own the businesses, like the bottle stores, aren't it?
Yeah, obviously, yeah. A lot of them are in the business community, and you know they want them. They don't want any more to arrive. They want them kicked out. But then, at the same time, they sort of seem to forget that you know they wouldn't be so rich if they hadn't exploited those vulnerable temporary visa holding migrants. So it's very. I think people are very confused. Yeah, that's all I can say. These people they don't actually understand the entire situation. They're kind of sort of limited to themselves. So, you know, if they're not going to have many migrant workers here, okay, that's all right. They can employ Kiwis, who then will be a lot more difficult to exploit. So, you know, we're happy to go with that.
Yeah.
And part of the new laws, John, is that if these guys are caught exploiting migrant workers, they can be struck off the register for employing migrant workers in the future?
Yeah, when we look back at the Employment Standards Bill, you know, for us that was the big victory around any zero-hour contracts. But the bill had been sitting there for a while, and one of its major goals was to give increased power to the Labour Inspectorate, including increasing penalties. They can fine up to 3 times the amount of money made from the breach. We don't have that power. It's Labour Inspectorate only, which is disappointing. And one of those powers is to enforce banning orders on employing migrants. We've just seen a list come around recently from the ministry. There was 70 businesses on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're out there doing it. I mean, the Labour Inspectorate isn't doing much else. You pretty much need migrant workers, minimum standards exploitation. Mm-hmm. And when I say migrant workers, you need a cluster of migrant workers, but they have done some really good work in that field with their limited resource. Keep going, start having a flow on effect at some point.
Yeah, regardless of policy change, one of the things that I'm kind of looking out for is just the danger that the anti-migrant and the racist rhetoric can do. I mean, we've seen that in the United States with some of the horrible attacks, that when you start giving voice to this kind of language, it just takes one person to think that that kind of behaviour is okay. And that's just regardless of any changes in the law.
Yeah, well, I was at Geneva at that international meeting of food workers, and there was an American woman, can't remember her name, a Hispanic woman from Los Angeles, who had been on the protest in Charlottesville only weeks before against the Ku Klux Klan and the racists who were marching with their torches and all this stuff. But some of them openly Nazi, with Nazi flags, you know, some terrific people according to Trump, right? And she'd seen a young union organizer killed in front of her, right, when the car hit the people, right? And the passion that this woman spoke with, like, blew me away. You know, like, it's very clear to me that things are polarizing in America on one side and on the other. Do you know what I mean? That you have these racist scumbags with all their prejudice on one side, but then in on the other, you got something that's far to the left of where Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party were. Do you know what I mean? And this is a movement that's on the streets with Fight for 15, but also Black Lives Matter and this kind of anti-Trump kind of feeling that they have as well, you know? So I thought that was very, very hopeful that the most radical speech in this whole conference came from the United States of America.
You know, that's the benefit of a Trump presidency is people have to decide where they stand and they have to be public with their racism and can call them out on it.
And the realization that this isn't just a scapegoat, like an attack on gay people or an attack on Muslim people, that when these people attack, they're going to come for all of us. Do you know what I mean? Like that Pastor Niemöller poem, you know, first they came for the communists, I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the trade unions, I didn't speak up because I wasn't for them. Then they came for the Muslims, and then they came for me. And there was no one left to speak for me. And there's that feeling in America that the regime has been picking on Muslims and then picking on gay people recently and then picking on women.
Puerto Rico.
And now they're coming for the unions, right? And what was interesting about the McStrike thing and stuff is like those American unions were making a choice at that time whether they were going to get into the bunker or whether they were going to keep it out in the streets. And it looks like they made the choice to keep it fighting on the streets, strikes in 450 cities and towns and fast food workers around America at that time. So that is good, you know, like as the challenge of racism rises, so we need to move in the streets, you know.
Okay, I think we'll take one more break and then Joe, you can tell us a bit more about Geneva, I think. and we're back. And we're just hearing from Joe from Unite about his time in Geneva. Where were you at again, Joe?
So this was the International Union of Food Workers global meeting. They meet every 5 years. And Unite Union, we joined this international a few years ago after the Zero Hours victory, or maybe just before. But because we recently started working with unions in America and in Britain who wanted to learn how Unite did it, how we organise fast food and other kind of precarious workers here, like cinema workers, security guards and stuff like that. And so it's really good that those big countries in the centre of the Anglosphere, if you like, are starting to do what we've done 10 years ago in New Zealand, you know. And so like that kind of, what did Trotsky call it, combined and uneven development, you know, that sometimes at the edges, at the periphery, the most radical things happen, you know. The revolution happens in St. Petersburg instead of Berlin. You know, how did that happen? Well, you know, circumstances. So here, New Zealand, being this place that's often left off global maps, you know, this is like this series, Maps Without New Zealand, you know. And, but people find that, and then they like double check, right? They go, what, you mean you got rid of 0 hours completely, right? And so then they go, oh, okay, how'd you do that? Oh, you've got a union in fast food. You're like, you're not just protesting to get one, because the Americans started that, didn't they?
Yeah, well, back us up. How did you do that?
Yeah. Whoa, hold on, wait a minute.
A step ahead of us there.
You see? So there was all, so anyway, we were brought to this to kind of talk about that, myself and Matt McCartan. So I was kind of talking about the campaign side of things, how we did it then, how we continued to do it. And then Matt talked about the politics, do you know what I mean? The vision of kind of a movement for the working poor, and then how we pushed forward and got actually real tangible changes inside companies and inside government too, which is kind of like a very important component, do you know what I mean? Because you can protest, do you know what I mean? But you got to deliver, like workers want to see victory, do you know what I mean? So that kind of knowing how to get there is a very important skill that I think not many people have, you know, on the left, that we need to really learn from actually struggle, you know. Mm. Can't be read in a book. That's got to be learned through struggle. So it was great meeting up with Matt again and doing all these adventures. But I have to say, some of the people that I met in Geneva just blew me away in terms of the bravery that they have. And I felt that I learned, like, so much about what was happening in our region of the Pacific. Mm. For example, in Thailand, they overthrew the government. They've got a military government there. And the women who are organising the union in KFC, who I met, like, 3 years ago in New York, are still at it now under dictatorship. And they were saying that when they finish negotiations, they've all got to run out of the building in separate ways.
Wow.
Because a gathering of more than four people is illegal under the dictatorship. So you just like hear these people going, wow, you know. I met a comrade from Haiti who was organizing, who'd organized the union in a Carlsberg bottling plant there, right? So what the international union seems to do is it's kind of got wealthier unions from, say, Scandinavia and Germany, and they're kind of flush, and they help to fund organising drives in the poor countries, which I think is really good solidarity, do you know what I mean? And these people are up against it. I mean, there's death squads and mafia and all sorts in Haiti. It was the place where black slaves first had a successful revolution with Toussaint Louverture in the 1790s. So since then, it's been attacked by Spain, France, America, like no one's ever allowed Haiti really do what it wanted to do. And, you know, you see this, you know, ebonic, strong comrade who's still part of the slave revolt, you know, 200 years later, organizing his beer factory with the knowledge that he could be shot at any time. Do you know what I mean? Like, that is a hero, right? And life is so cheap that the odds are pretty high. So you meet comrades from Latin America, Colombia. I met a brilliant speaker from Tunisia who was talking about how the revolutions of 2011, the Arab Spring, had been stolen from the people, either with military dictatorship like in Egypt. We met some of those people under that boot, or the Islamic fundamentalists, you know, filling the vacuum. And he talked about how in Tunisia that they were lucky that that hadn't happened, but it didn't happen because of the Union Federation. That when they had the revolution in 2011, when that young vegetable seller burned himself to death in protest against austerity, that the steam of the movement went into the piston of the union structures and revitalized that and made it a huge working class movement that they still have in Tunisia, that the government couldn't crush, that the Islamic fundamentalists couldn't get round. And he was really, really passionate. You know, it was like one of those speeches where you're going, I don't speak Arabic, but I reckon I know what he's saying right here. And the translators were telling you, yep.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to meet these amazing heroes and heroines from around the world that I think you do that, and it gives you energy when you come back to your city, your town, your country. Do you know what I mean? That you're aware that we're part of this international brotherhood and sisterhood of people who are, you know, in some countries, really, really up against it as well, fighting for what we got.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think a lot of unions in New Zealand are struggling to shake off that stereotype of being really old and dated and dinosaurs and asleep at the wheel. And you've just given us plenty of examples of places around the world going through tremendous social change, really dynamic, intense places where they're a crucial part of it.
Yeah, and in a lot of circumstances, young and black and female as well, you know. So that was the great thing about this this meeting, you know, was meeting all different cultures and stuff, you know, but with class politics at the center of it. Yeah, great.
Well, Joe's story reminds me of seeing something on the internet, watching TV. My partner had found something about textile workers, so I believe it was Bangladesh.
Oh, yeah.
And it was I was doing something else at the time. You think, you know, you see the horrible conditions that they're facing and how terrible it is, and you think, oh, they need to unionize. And then, like, seconds after I'd said that, the voiceover commentator says, well, you know, they tried to unionize a few months ago, and the organizer was shot. And it's just...
Right. It's, makes
yeah,
it difficult.
It's a little wake-up that, yeah, in other parts of the world, people who do your job are just killed for trying to do it.
Yeah. Which is why those international forums are really important and cool, I think. Keep the flush ones, like the Scandinavian unions, like you mentioned, Joe, in touch with where the movement's starting out in other places.
And I remember that, Bangladesh, because after the Triangle Fire of New York, that was the worst fire in the world, eh? The fire in Dhaka, was it?
Rana Plaza.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the week that that happened, we hit Queen Street in Auckland, Just Jeans and all those clothes shops, do you remember?
Yeah.
And we put a leaflet in, are you going to support the Dhaka Accord or not, which was what the Union Federation in Bangladesh called for, which was an end to sweatshops and only buy from union things, and they all collapsed within like 24 hours. Like, they were so aware of the rage that around the world about all those women being burned to death, chained in the factory, you know?
Oh, fire exits were chained, were they?
Yeah. So that was kind of like another Grenfell, if you like, in terms of clothing and sweatshops around the world. You know, it was very, very easy. All those companies were so paranoid that they're rags would be associated with those women who were burned to death. Do you know what I mean? That union demand from Bangladesh went very quickly around the world. And I mean, in the early 90s, we used to have Students Against Sweatshops, which was kind of the campaign. We didn't have unions, but we knew this Nike and Adidas were shit, you know, we knew. And then later on, there was women like Dita Sari who organized the union, the revolution in Indonesia. But, like, she organized 30,000 Nike and Adidas workers in Surabaya, you know what I mean? Like, these are the heroes of the 21st century, you know, these people who are organizing in Phnom Penh and Vietnam and, you know, Khartoum, you know? And we don't get a chance to really meet them, you know, face to face. But, you know, when you do, I think it gives you, you know, what are we worried about? Winston Peters? Fucking easy.
All right. On that note, I think we should all mention a little bit about what's going on in Auckland.
Yep. Last week, there was, our listeners would have seen it in mainstream media, a worker at the Bottle-O liquor store here in Point Chef, Manjinder Singh, who he's been in the country for about 3.5 years now, and he came here as an international student from a very poor background, as a lot of international students are from India. So he's got a lot of debt from back home to fund his entire venture here. So he needed to work. Most of them do. They have to work as well, which they are allowed. They're allowed 20 hours while they are studying. So he got a job at the liquor store. He was taken on for 2 months as a trial, but he wasn't told that by the employer. He was just like, he went along, and so he said, okay, you know, we want to see how you work. So he worked for two months, and at the end of it, they told him, right, okay, we you're okay, we like your work, so we give you a longer-term job, but we will not pay you for the last 2 months because that was just a trial. Now, that in itself, it's not allowed in the New Zealand Employment Act, so...
Oh, yeah, that's the 60-day law, you've heard of that.
Is it?
No, I just made that up.
Yeah, I know, like these employers do as they go along. He started working there. So the deal was he would have to work for 35 hours every week to get the pay that he deserved for 20 hours. So as a student, he can only work 20 hours, but he was forced to work 35 hours and then got paid for 20 only. So that went on for, I think, a good couple of years while he was studying. He finished his qualification. The same employer offered him a full-time job, which is 35 hours. And so he got his work visa with that employer. So he's attached to that employer. And now to get paid for 35 hours, he had to work at least 60 hours every week. Never got any breaks. He tells us that, you know, he'd be allowed about 5 minutes to eat his lunch, and even then, if it was 6-7 minutes, they'd be on his back, you know, why are you taking extra time? So no annual leave, no sick leave. His father passed away last year in December. After he put up a big fight, he was allowed to go to India for 20 days. And that was unpaid leave, so no bereavement leave, so nothing there. So after all that, the worker decided he's had enough, so he started negotiating, talking with his employer. Look, he calculated his hours, and according to him, he's owed $80,000 of unpaid wages, sick leave, annual leave, the breaks that he's missed. And the public holidays when he's worked, he's allowed time and a half. The employer has kept him dragging on for about 2 months. Okay, I'll pay you tomorrow, I'll pay you next week, this, that, the other. So and at the last minute, he always backs out. So then Manjinder decided, he complained to the Labour Inspectorate. So his complaint is in. Last week we protested against this employer, the Bottle-O, and it was quite interesting. The employer wasn't there himself. There was this another person there, which Manjinder had never ever seen before in his life. He doesn't know who this person is. The person claims to be the employer's brother. I don't know who he might be. He was quite abusive towards protesters, especially towards comrade Sunny Sehgal. He was very, very abusive to him in Indian language, and I wish we'd caught that on tape, but we didn't. We demanded that you can produce his time and wage records. We'll have a look at that and we'll settle this matter. But all they could produce was a receipt for an air ticket. So when Manjinder went to his father's funeral in India last year, obviously he didn't have the money to buy the ticket. So the employer bought the ticket for him. The reason being, he wanted to control when Mjinder leaves and when comes back. And also the condition was that it's a loan. As soon as he comes back, he will repay him.
I think this case has really exposed a lot of the practices that have been hidden from sight. And fair play to Mjinder Singh and the Migrant Workers Association. But really, this stuff has to end.
Yeah.
And our message to whatever new government comes in is that we're not having this anymore in our community. Mount Albert will be hunting down employers like this. It doesn't matter how many bottle stores you have pushing your liquor in our community, but the workers there, if you're exploiting them, we'll get you shut down. We'll go to the liquor board, we'll go to the licensing board, the community boards, and we'll go to MBIE. And if they don't do their job, we'll do the job.
Yeah, keep the pressure on, right? Cool. All right, well, I think we'll wrap up now. Kia ora, everyone. And, keep listening.
Thanks for listening to Workers' Voice. This show was produced by Unite Union. Listen to us every third Wednesday of the month at 2:10 p.m. or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/workersvoice.
Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. Hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.